Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you by Ironman U, by EverySite.com, by RunCatalina.com. Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $70 million to keep athletes in the game alive through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes or Babbittville.com. Our guest, Sarah Pianpiano, one Ironman win, two Ironman 70.3 wins, 10 podiums, and seventh in Kona this past October. Sarah, how are you?
I'm very well, Bob. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, no problem. So I'm reading through the bio, and I'm going, okay, it's three, you break your wrist riding a bike.
No, wait.
You're on skis at two, and you break your wrist at three. Talk a little bit about, it sounds like you were sort of the human test dummy for the family. Your brothers are putting you in ski bags, all sorts of different stuff. Talk about growing up.
Yeah, so I grew up with two older brothers. My oldest brother is 9 years older than me, and my other brother 6 years older than me. And so, I really looked up to them as a kid, from a very, very early age. And honestly, whatever it was that they were doing, that's what I wanted to do. So if they were skiing, I wanted to ski. If they were playing hockey, I wanted to play hockey. If they were riding a two-wheeler, I wanted to ride a two-wheeler. If they were running around with their shirts off, I wanted to run around with my shirt off. I mean, I really just wanted to emulate whatever it was they were doing. And as a kid, I took a lot of beatings from them, and we laugh about it now, but I feel as though it really shaped me as a person and everything that I am today, because, they were never sympathetic towards me. They never felt bad for me if I hurt myself. They never actually really cared that much if I hurt myself. The only thing they wanted to see me do was, I guess, succeed.
Right.
So it kind of gave me this mentality in everything that I've always done growing up, that you don't take no for an answer. There's no I can't. It's always I can. And it's just a matter of figuring out how to do it and, how to succeed at it. And it may take a little bit of time, but, you'll get there if you put your head down and you work hard enough. And so I definitely was brutalized, but I think it's kind of paid off over the long run.
So when I see the different nicknames, Little Red, I get, Piomps, I get, mm-hmm. Pimp, I get, Piano, I get, Pom Pom, I get, Little P, get that, Gimpy Gimster, is that basically because of injuries? That one,
yeah.
I don't get.
So when I was a senior in college, I got a blood clot in my leg, and I was on crutches for about 2 months.
Yeah.
And so all of my friends in college started calling me Gimpy, and it stuck. And to this day, all of my college friends still call me Gimpy. And it kind of morphed into Gimpster, which is,
the Gimpster. It's a Gimperoonie. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can see
where
that
was really funny. And actually, when I first started doing triathlon, they all got together and they created a triathlon kit for me. And on the triathlon kit was a pack of cigarettes and crutches and a bottle of alcohol. Those are the three things.
The necessities. Kit. The necessities of life.
Exactly. But yeah, that's where it came from.
So as a youngster, 8 years old, runner, qualified junior Olympic cross country championships in Reno. And that sounds like obviously you were a serious skier as well, but the running seemed to have touched a nerve for you.
Yeah, I think, as a little kid, I pretty much participated in every sport possible, as so many kids do. I played soccer, I was playing basketball, I played softball, I played, I went and I was on the cross country team, I skied, I did all these things. And honestly, I think the thing that really captured my attention was qualifying for the national championships. As a little kid, being 8 years old, qualifying for this national championship race, being able to miss school, get on a plane, go to another state and do a race, I mean, this was, like, amazing, right? And, you know, gave me kind of bragging rights with all my friends, and it was so cool. And for me, you know, it was less about, I think, the running and more just about how great that experience was. And that's what I think initially really inspired me. And after that, I did become a lot more serious about running, and I was very good at it at an early age, and let it kind of take off from there. And as you said, I also was a ski racer. And so as I got older, I did have to make kind of a decision whether to go down the running route or the ski racing route. But definitely the running, I was better at running than I was ski racing, let's put it that way. But I ended up choosing ski racing.
So you were at 14, you're eighth at the National Cross Country Championship. And I'm assuming that's when you were. So did you run all through high school?
I didn't, actually. So when I was about 10, that's when I got quite serious about running. And I had private coaches, and so I was participating in school programs. But then outside of school programs, I was working with a private coach almost every day. And I took it very, very seriously. And really, when I was 14, 15 years old, my freshman and sophomore year, I started to get quite burned out of running. And, you know, my freshman year, everybody was calling me the freshman phenom and all this stuff. And I was getting letters from colleges already and people looking at me. And I just started feeling like my identity was too built around running. You know, my parents would go to parties and they would say, oh, your daughter's the runner. And I didn't want to be known as the runner. I wanted to be known as Sarah, you know, and sure. I wanted to have the opportunity to go out with my friends and sort of have these experiences that every teenager has. And too much of myself was committed to running. And so really, actually, after my sophomore year, I told my parents that I didn't want to run anymore. And I was quite nervous to tell them that because they had just committed so much of themselves to, you know, helping me excel in the sport. And I didn't want to let them down. But I also it was too much for me at that point in my life. And so after my sophomore year, I quit running, and I actually ended up going my junior and senior years to a ski academy in Vermont, Stratton Mountain School, where I focused more on skiing. So even though I was burned out of running, I then went and competed at an equally high intensity in another sport. But the good thing for me with the ski racing was, you know, I was in an environment where everybody around me was also trying to excel at this really high level. And so I felt like I was, you know, I was just surrounded by people who were trying to do the same thing. And there was a lot more camaraderie and friendship. And I didn't kind of feel so isolated as I felt when I was running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in college, you were captain across you. So you got back in the cross country.
Yes. So I actually studied abroad my freshman year of college. And then when I came back from that, I kind of wanted to start running again, which, you know, it took me a while before I was really interested in starting to do anything related to running. But I went and I joined the cross country team, and I ran my sophomore, junior, and senior year. And I would say that I did it more for the love of running than to truly be really competitive. I think I had a lot of anxiety around taking it too seriously and getting burned out again. And so I never, in college, never ran at the level that I ran at in high school. I was a slower runner in college than I was in high school, but it was a really wonderful experience for me and brought back the love of running for me.
I mean, you're talking about a sport where you could be running 5-minute miles, and then you're talking about ski racing where you're going, 60 miles an hour? We're talking two very different highs from two very different sports. I could totally understand if I was talented at ski racing, I'd much rather do that than be hurting running. Were you thinking Olympics with skiing?
Yeah, when I was younger, my dream was to be the first athlete to compete in both the Winter and Summer Olympics. That's kind of what I wanted to be growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to run in the marathon, and then I wanted to, you know, go and win an Olympic medal in, downhill or super G. But yeah, I mean, the whole purpose of me going to ski academy was to try to make the US ski team. And I did compete at a very high level. I think, there's, what's called one below World Cup is called Europa Cup, which I think would be like the equivalent of kind of continental cups or.
Right. Or AAA in baseball, that type of thing.
Yeah, something like that. And so I competed in Europa Cups, but that was the extent of, I never competed at the World Cup level, and I was never named to the US ski team. And, you know, it's kind of funny because ski academies aren't known for their academic prowess, and my parents are both lawyers, and so when I told them I wanted to go to a ski academy, they said, absolutely not, you can't go. They said, the only way you can go is if you get a scholarship, thinking that, you know, given that the fact that they're both lawyers, there was no way that I was going to get a scholarship. But as with everything in my life, I put my head down and I found a way. And I applied to these ski academies and I got scholarships. And so my parents didn't say no. So they let me go and they said, okay, well, you can go to these schools, but unless you make the USD team by the time you graduate, you have to go to college, because a lot of people take postgraduate years and delay going to college to try to make the ski team. And so I made that agreement with them. And, you know, senior year came around, I didn't make the USD team. And so
then
I graduated and moved on to college. Yep.
So, scariest moment in downhill skiing?
There was one race. It was a downhill race, and my parents were actually there for it, where I misread one of the jumps.
Yeah.
And to give everybody perspective, I mean, you're going 65, 70, 75 miles an hour. And what you need to do is you kind of pre-jump the jumps, and you travel about 150 feet through the air before you land.
Right.
And I misread it, and I just went flying through the air, went straight into the protective netting on the side of the trail, and got stuck and was like hanging upside down.
Oh.
And so there was a huge course delay. My parents are down below. You know, I'm supposed to be coming and I'm not.
Oh, God.
And the next thing they see is me getting
the
carried
toboggan,
down in
the toboggan thing. Yeah, they see you. I mean, who's that in the toboggan? Oh, yeah, there's Sarah.
Yeah, so that was not one of my best moments in ski racing.
So when you got out of college, at that point, you were focusing on business, right? And, you know, 2002, HSBC, Thomas Wiesel. The Thomas Wiesel Partners, that's the Lance era, right? When Thomas Wiesel
that
was.
That is the Lance
era,
yeah. In fact, when I was working for Thomas Wiesel, that was my first job out of college. Lance came in twice to the
speak.
Trading floor.
Yeah.
Yeah, just he like knew people, and everybody was all, you know, buddy with him. And of course, he was very close with Tom, so, you know, it was a lot of buzz on the trading floor every time he came by. But yeah,
that was
definitely the Lance era.
That's a brutal job working in the financial industry, because you were working 90, 100 hours a week.
Actually, when I first started, it was more than that. I mean, I was
more than
honestly,
that.
Oh yeah, I would work. Not every week, but there were weeks I would work 120 hours I'd pull multiple all-nighters during the week. And then when I wasn't pulling an all-nighter, I was sleeping under my desk or, you know, getting 1 or 2 hours a night. It was brutal. And that wasn't all the time. But, I mean, I was regularly working at least over 100 hours on a weekly basis. And you know, there were times that it was just terrible. I remember being in the office for Thanksgiving, and my boyfriend at the time brought me my Thanksgiving dinner to the office so I could eat there. And I remember going to my grandmother's funeral and being on a conference call, having pulled an all-nighter the night before, you know, in the car on the way to her service. I mean, it was a very intense environment.
And you're traveling Asia, South and Central America, Europe. I mean, that always sounds so cool and romantic. You're traveling the world, but it's basically one hotel room to another.
It is. And I mean, there were times when I would make a trip to China where I would literally, you know, it was a 14-hour flight from New York. I would fly in, I'd go for a 3 or 4 hour meeting, and then I would go to the airport and fly home. So, I mean, it was crazy, some of the trips that you'd make. And it was, you know, it was a wonderful experience for me. I do feel like I was able to experience different cultures in a way that you obviously never would be able to, you know, if you were going there as a tourist or something like that. It was very fascinating to, for example, experience the Chinese culture and the way that they do business and sure. sort of the sense of pride and ownership they have and all these companies, which are a lot of first-generation companies and things like that. So it was a really wonderful experience for me.
For you, this must be, you know, when you're talking about training 20 to 25 hours a week, you're probably going, this is like half day. Well, this is not a big deal. You guys are complaining about, oh my God, I got to be on the bike for 5 hours. You're like, I was on a conference call and then going on a plane and then meeting with clients and then I didn't sleep at that time. Does it seem sometimes that you're looking at this going, these people have no idea what real work is?
Well, it's funny because when I first got into triathlon, you know, I would come home, no joke, I would get home at like 2 o'clock in the morning and I would get on my trainer and do my bike session at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I just like could never imagine doing now.
Right.
So when I first turned pro and I left my job and all, had all this time, I was like, wow, this is so nice. This is so great. Like, I didn't even know what to do with myself.
Right. It's like a vacation. You're going, yeah, okay, yeah, it's like noon and I'm done. I did all my workouts. I love that.
I know. There was just so much time, and I got to go to bed at, you know, 8 o'clock and take naps, and it was awesome. But yeah, I mean, it's not a life that I would ever want to go back to at this point. I can't imagine only sleeping 1 or 2 hours a night. It's just kind of crazy. Unfathomable to me. Like I can't even believe that I did that.
So speaking of unhealthy. You were smoking cigarettes, drinking a little bit, probably not eating that well. No. What was the turning point? Was it the challenge to do a triathlon?
Yeah. So in 2009, I was in New York City, and that's where I was living and working at the time. And one of my friends from college, he had put on about 50 pounds. Since we had graduated from school, and he had signed up for a triathlon to try to kind of motivate himself to get fit and lose weight and become a bit healthier. He also worked in finance. And we were out one night at a bar, and I was smoking, of course, and he was telling me about this triathlon, and it just, honestly, I can't even quite remember why I felt compelled or motivated. It might have just been my competitiveness that I, you know, have always carried with me, but I said, oh, you know, that sounds fun. I'll do it with you. You know, we could bet. I wonder, you know, I bet I could beat you. And then all of our friends started kind of chiming in as to who, you know, thought, you know, whether they thought I would beat Todd or Todd would beat me or, you know, so on and so forth. So it all sort of culminated in us making this bet. And so that was kind of the impetus around me going and doing that first triathlon. And, you know, I would say that I had been wanting to make some changes in my life. I had joined a gym and had been trying to go and run, but I just wasn't really that inspired by, you know, going to a gym and working out. And I had wanted to stop smoking, but it was kind of the only, for me, seemed like the only real stress reliever that I was afforded at the time. And so I went to this triathlon. I hadn't trained. I rode on my brother's bike that he lent to me that he had bought in Paris 15 years earlier for $200. So you can imagine the state of this thing.
Oh, yeah.
So I rode on that bike. I went out and rented a wetsuit and rocked up to this triathlon. I was actually the Moose Man.
Oh, Moose Man, okay.
Triathlon, yeah. But it was before it was owned by Ironman.
Right.
And I didn't even race under my name. I raced under somebody else's name because the triathlon was sold out. My friend decided she wasn't going to race. She just wanted to watch the competition between Todd and I. So I raced under her name and went and did the race and
did well.
It just, I finished in 3 hours and
wow for an that Olympic distance race.
For my first Olympic distance race, I hadn't trained, and it just, I don't know. It was honestly one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Just being out there, doing something good for myself, which was incredible. You know, being in a competitive environment, which I haven't been in such a long time, was, you know, was just so great for me and kind of my mental health. And then also, I think seeing people from all walks of life, all sizes, all shapes, all gender, you know, everything coming together and putting themselves in this position and really challenging themselves in a way that I hadn't seen or experienced before. And I was just so blown away by the moment and the experience and the sense of community and everything about it. That it just, it was completely transformational for me in terms of, you know, my mindset and what it was I wanted to do after that point.
Well, you know, basically when you go to a race, it's like a party. Everybody's happy. People are paying to be there. So nobody's unhappy when they're there, right? You might go through some miserable times during the event itself, but, you know, everybody's smiling. Everybody's, it's you against the course. Nobody's saying, oh, you beat me. It's just, there's a very special feeling to a triathlon.
Exactly. And, you know, I actually remember on the bike, there was a gentleman who I kept passing him and then he passed me. And, you know, after the race, we saw each other and we had a good laugh about it and things like that. And it's just like any triathlon you go to, there's just this incredible sense of community. And it's a very humbling experience where, you know, you really have to look within yourself and, you know, see what you're made of and fight through some tough times. And it's just, I don't know, it was amazing. So
what I love is the first race is in 09, and then in 10, I'm assuming you did a bunch, and next thing you know, you're going pro, right, and working with Matt Dixon, one of the best coaches around from Purple Patch Fitness. Talk a little bit about that transformation from, hey, I'm going to, I'm going to jump in and do this triathlon and beat my bud, and now I'm thinking of going pro.
So after that race, in our goodie bags at the race, they had given us actually a copy of Triathlete magazine.
Yeah.
And on the way home, I sat in the back seat of the car and I just poured over the magazine. And I was so into it and, you know, reading about, you know, all the race results and the, you know, tips on racing and diets and, you know, all the stuff that Triathlete has. And I was just so inspired by it. And I thought, well, I could be really good at this. So I went out and I bought a bike and I started training a little bit and I did go and I did another race. And when I was training maybe like an hour a day, 5 days a week type of thing. When I went and did the second race, I was about 45 minutes faster than the first one.
And if I do that three more times, I'm going to the Olympics.
Exactly. That was exactly what I thought. I'm like, wow, I'm going to be winning the gold medal in the next Olympics.
maybe by Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, I really thought I was going to the Olympics to the point that I started telling people that I thought that I had a chance of going to the Olympics.
Right. I've been in the sport for a minute and a half, and I'm going to the Olympics. So you better book your trip to Rio.
I know. So I reached out to, at that point, I kind of, after that second race, I decided, you know, maybe I could go to the Olympics and maybe I could be really good at this. And if I wanted to be the best, I needed to be coached by, you know, one of the best coaches in the world. So I did a bunch of research and I reached out to a whole handful of, all the best coaches,
sure.
Cliff English and Brett Sutton and Matt, of course, and, a whole host of coaches. And interestingly, I mean, I had a lot of conversations with many of them, and they were supportive of me going pro. And I got on the phone with Matt, and he said, no, thanks, but no thanks, first of all. And he also said, and by the way, if I were to coach you, I wouldn't let you go pro.
Right.
Which, you know, if anybody knows anything about me, I kind of like a little bit of a challenge.
It's so sort of like mom and dad saying you're not.
No to
yeah,
me.
Yeah. It's like mom and dad saying you're not going to ski camp unless you get a scholarship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I like this guy. So I hopped on a plane.
Yeah.
And I flew out to San Francisco and I said, Matt, I'm in San Francisco. Can you meet with me? And he said, well, I have 15 minutes. I can meet you for coffee. Like, all right, fine. I'll meet you for coffee. And I'll never forget the conversation I had with Matt. I mean, our coffee ended up being about an hour.
Yeah.
And he during the course of the conversation said to me, what do you want in a sport? And I looked down and I said, I want to be world champion because, you know, I'm a young triathlete. I haven't really had that much success. And here I am saying I want to be world champion. He said, look me in the eye and tell me what you want. And I looked him in the eye and I said, I want to be world champion. And he said, you have a fire about you. He's like, your results don't show it, but I can see you've got a lot of gumption, and I'll coach you.
Love that.
So, and I think, you know, if you talk to him now, he'll say the same thing. You know, it's just, he wasn't really that inspired by the results I showed as an athlete, but he could see something in my, you know, in my demeanor and my attitude that he really liked. And so we started working together at the end of 2010. And you know, as he said, the first conversation we had, you know, I couldn't go pro until he said that I was ready, because his feeling was that a lot of people go pro far too early.
He's right.
And they haven't really achieved both the emotional development and physical development that you really need to be able to succeed as a pro if you want to compete at a very high level, which I did and do.
So, and then were you still working?
So what we decided was in 2011, I was going to see if my company, HSBC, would be willing to let me work with reduced hours, and that would give me more time to focus on training and kind of see how my results shaped up and whether or not going down the professional route was even something that was going to make sense. Because right now, like at the time, I was working so much, my training was so compromised and up and down that it just was hard to get a true sense of maybe what my potential was or where I might be able to be as an athlete. And so I went and approached HSBC, and they were so, you know, honestly surprisingly supportive. I think, you know, investment banking is such a cutthroat environment, and typically if somebody were to approach a bank and say, hey, do you mind instead of working 120 hours, I work 40 hours a week and don't travel anymore and only work 4 days a week. And by the way, I'm going to go to all these training camps throughout the year. They'd be like, yeah, whatever. See you later.
Nice knowing you. Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But they actually were really supportive. And they said, you know, we'll give you 1 year to give this a go. And we think it's great that you're doing it, and we'll support you in it. And they did that. And they stood by it.
Wow.
And
that's
so
really
for
cool.
all of, yeah, I mean, it was truly, I'm forever indebted to them because they didn't have to do that. And it was, I think, a really important thing for me to be able to do as an athlete, to be able to kind of see where things were going to lead.
Yeah, and then when you finally, in 2012, when you left your job, that had to be scary.
It was terrifying. You know, you go from a position of relative, well, from a position
security,
of financial
right?
security
yeah,
and
yeah.
job security and, you know, cheap health insurance and
exactly
you know,
all the benefits, absolutely 401k, all the different
yeah.
stuff that go with a real job. To
yeah.
you're an independent contractor, hoping to you know make a few bucks as a professional triathlete.
Exactly. So it was scary, and you know, I think on one hand, I think that's where, you know, we talked about at the beginning. You know, my relationship with my brothers and growing up. I think that's where things. You know, that personality trait and character in me, like, really comes out. Because, you know, when I quit my job, it wasn't like, oh, gosh, I hope I can do this. Oh, gosh, I hope I can do this. It was like, I am doing this. I'm going to be successful at it. And, okay, let me figure out how I'm going to be successful at it, you know. So, you know, I look back now, and I'm able to admit and reflect and talk about how stressful and how scary of a time it was. But in the moment and at the time, I wouldn't even, like, let myself go there and contemplate that, you know, that emotion, because it was just totally focused on
success.
Putting myself in as best a position as possible and success, exactly.
Well, what I love is, I mean, your brothers were really damn creative in the stuff they did. You know, one, zipping you into a hockey bag is cool, but the blueberries from a pellet gun, that is awesome stuff. And I'm just sitting there going, I can see them staying up at night going, what are we going to do to her today? How about let's get some blueberries, put them in the freezer, and then just nail her. I guess these guys were the best.
Oh, God. They were so, so bad at me. There were so many things. Like, we used to go catch snakes, and they would say, you know, if you put your finger right by their mouth, they'll lick you.
Oh, they did
so
not.
I didn't do that, and they did. And I got seriously bitten by a snake once. I put my finger right there. The thing did not lick me. It, like, latched onto me and bit me.
And they were laughing.
Oh, they thought it was the best.
Oh,
that was so great.
Man, they are the best.
Oh, God.
They should be doing a triathlon camp. Those guys should be making everybody tough. So you come out to L.A. working with Jerry Rodriguez, one of the absolute best swim coaches around.
Yes.
You're competing as a professional. In April, you win, it's 2012, you win Ironman New Orleans 70.3. That had to be sort of reassurance that, okay, I'm going in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, that was a shock to my system.
Yeah,
to be fair, I mean, I was biking and running scared that entire race. I mean, there were some big names in that field. You know, Heather Wortel was racing, yep. Amy Marsh was racing, Rennie was racing, Magley was racing. I mean, there were some incredible racers there. And I just remember... pretty much I remember getting off the bike and just running for my life. And saying, don't blow up, don't blow up, don't blow up, don't blow up. But it showed me that whether it happened, you know, instantaneously or a bit down the road, that I had the ability and potential to be able to compete at a high level. And, you know, I don't think that the rest of my season played out and I'll, you know, I didn't sort of compete at that level again the rest of the year.
Right.
But it definitely, for me, sort of reset a standard and set an expectation for myself going forward that I, you know, of where I wanted to be and where I expected myself to be.
So what was your full Ironman win?
What's that?
Did you get a full Ironman win?
Not until
not yet.
December.
This last year, right?
Yeah, yeah. In December, I won Ironman Western Australia.
There you go.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, last year, it was interesting because in that first 70.3 win, it was so unexpected that it kind of took a lot out of me emotionally, just because I wasn't expecting to win a race. You know, with Rennie and, you know, all these
sure.
people in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, this last year, 2015, and from an athlete development standpoint, you know, I really, and Matt really expected me to be stepping up and starting to compete at a much higher level. So, you know, getting that second win in New Orleans this last year, and then even my first Ironman win, it was an incredibly sweet and wonderful moment, but it also is at a point in my career where that sort of expectation now.
Yeah, your expectation. You've had 10 podium performances, so you're thinking, when I go to starting line, I'm a contender. I can win this race.
Yeah.
So what impresses me when I look at splits from Kona, and this was your first Kona, correct?
Actually, I raced my first year as a pro.
Oh, okay. In 2012.
Yep, and then the following year I actually qualified, but I declined my spot because Matt's feeling, I think this was really smart of him, you know, I qualified my first year, and he said, go and race Kona as a celebration of, you know, a year of great work, and, you know, just go and enjoy the moment, have the experience and get the experience. And then my second year I qualified, and he said, I don't think that you should go back and race, because when we go back and we race Kona again, it's to compete. It's to, you know, try to be top 10. It's not to just go and have the experience again. It's to go and really race there.
You've already toured the race. You know
right.
the course, right? Yeah. So next time
right.
you're there to be a factor.
Right. So, you know, we didn't think that I was in a position as an athlete to really be competitive in a race like that. And so I declined my spot. Then 2014, I was injured, and so, yeah, 2015 was my second time racing.
Nice. And, I mean, by the time when I look at all the swim times, I'm sitting there going, okay.
Oh, God.
One, Sarah didn't have a problem finding her bike, right? Her bike was pretty easy to spot because the other girls are like 56, 56, 56, 56, 57, 110. And it's like, okay. So you had a little work to do on the bike.
Oh, Bob, let me tell you, it was so funny because, you know, the slow clap for the people who are really at the back of the race.
Yeah.
I got the slow clap.
You got the golf clap?
The people were like, good job.
What happened? She must have flatted or something. What's going on? Oh, you got the golf clap.
Oh, I got the slow clap. Oh, it was so bad. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Were your folks there?
My mom was there.
Your mom was there, so she's probably looking at you. Wait, where those other girls were out of here 15 minutes ago. Where's Sarah at? I wonder what's going on.
Well, I mean, I think swimming is not my forte, and it continues to be something that we work on and I struggle at. So I didn't expect to be that far back.
Right.
But the fact that I was getting out towards the back wasn't like a shock to my system.
No,
right? It wasn't like I was a front pack swimmer and like suddenly I was like way out the back.
Lost your goggles.
And I do think actually one of the great things that Matt and Jerry helped me with it this last year is I used to put so much pressure on myself in my swim performance and saying like the only way I'm going to be able to, you know, win races and do this is I have to get better at the swim. I have to get better at swim. And actually in our winter training camp last year, Matt and Jerry sat me down and they said, Sarah, you have two great strengths. You have, and two great weapons. You have a great bike and you have a great and much improving run.
Yes.
And they said, Rinny has an amazing run and she wins world championships with an amazing run.
Yep.
You know, and you know, if you have two great weapons, you can win, you know, you can be there. So stop putting the pressure on yourself on the swim and start focusing on the things that you're great at. And so ever since then, for me with racing, you know, of course I try as hard as I can to be, you know, to be better at the swim, but I don't put as much stress and pressure on myself. And I think that makes a big difference from a mental perspective in races when no matter how far back I get out on the swim, I just kind of put it beside me and I move on to the bike and the run where I know I can perform better.
Well, and you know, the nice thing, and one of the things that I think has been helpful for Rinny over the years, a lot of times you'll see, you know, the gals who are really good swimmers, the 56-minute swimmers sort of racing the bike ride early on like it's a crit. You know, the person, people are going off the front, where the folks who are swimming a little further back and are have a little more alone time can really just think about their watts, can just focus on themselves and not get caught up in the other stuff, which at the end of the day, Rennie's been able to, you know, run 15, 16 minutes faster than a lot of these folks by riding consistently throughout the day, which obviously you can do.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that, you know, for anybody who spends time looking at Kona and looking at the results and watching, you know, seeing how the race unfolds, you know that it comes down to the run. So much happens on the run and really in the last 10 miles. And Matt and I had talked about that. And so, and I think you're right. You know, I think that a lot of those top girls who are incredibly talented, by the way, and are just phenomenal athletes, they get onto the bike and then it's like this fight. And I think particularly actually this year with, you know, Daniela in the mix and knowing how strong of a bike rider she was and people not wanting to necessarily let her go, people at the front of the race are just completely putting themselves out there on the bike and taking a lot of risks and a lot of chances and
blowing up,
you know, and blowing up. And that's, you know, those are the consequences versus I think actually being at the back, you know, you see that saw the same thing with like Heather Jackson, right? And, you know, you can actually go and really race your own race, which is kind of what you need to do in Kona.
What I like is with a 110 swim, you have nowhere to go but up, right? I mean, you start taking, you know, over time, taking a couple minutes off here or there. Next thing you know, you're on the podium.
I know. And again, I mean, I give Matt so much credit in terms of race strategy because he set me up so well. He said, you know, whatever happens on the swim, happens on the swim. You get on the bike and you ride a managed conservative ride. You know, you still ride hard, but you ride managed.
Yep.
And he said the last 20 miles you get off the bike or you pull back.
Yep.
Like, I don't care where you are. I don't care if you're in 5th, if you're in 20th, you're in 15th. He's like, I don't care where you are on the bike. The last 20 miles you pull back and you start getting ready because it is going to come down to the run. And he said, and when you start the run, you do not chase. You just run a consistent, even pace. Where the race starts is the last 10 miles. And so, you know, I'm going through, I got off the bike, I think, in 17th, and I'm running along Elite Drive, and I'm seeing all these girls running so fast. And, you know, I'm just trucking along at my pace. And the next thing I know, I'm down in the Energy Lab. There are, like, 6 girls.
Right in front of you.
You know, right in front of me. And people were just dropping like flies.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, it all boils down to the last 10 miles.
It really does. You could talk all the technique, all the equipment, all the heart monitors, all the wattage. And what it comes down to is the last 10 miles on the pavement, right? When it's 100 degrees out and people are melting. It's who's got something left. And obviously, when you go, you know, 306, I think you had, like, what, the second fastest run of the second fastest marathon. That's pretty special. When I look at 924, you're going, okay, the only thing that separates you from those, you know, you outsplit someone like a Liz Blatchford on the bike, and she got you by a few seconds on a run. You were just about the same with, Rachel Joyce on the bike. She was like a minute faster. So you're right there. And it's just a matter of, and I think those guys are right. The swim is going to be what it is. And if you're coming out fresh, probably the best thing is as you get better as a swimmer, your time might not come on that much, but you're going to be fresher out of the water, right? So you can ride and you can perform in the two parts of the event that are your best.
Right. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, from a training perspective, our training strategies shifted a lot both last year and this year from when it had been the first few years. The first few years, we did focus a lot on my swim and less on my run and bike and then last year and again this year. I mean, this year is a big project for us. It's to build strength and efficiency on the bike and build speed on the run. I mean, our hope is to, you know, get me running under 3 hours consistently and run under 3 hours in Kona because not very many people can do that.
No. And that makes a huge difference. You start going, you know, right at 5 hours on the bike and go, you know, 2:55 in the run. It's a different game.
Yeah, exactly.
Love that. So your folks from HSBC, what are their thoughts now when they see you winning races and finishing 7th in Kona? They must be like, wow, Sarah was right.
Yeah, they love it. I mean, I get notes from them all the time. And, you know, some of them, they do triathlons. And, you know, last month there was a picture of a full-page picture of me and triathlete coming down the finish line from winning Western Australia. And they're all going berserk over it. They think it's so cool. And, you know, I think that a lot of people just kind of took it with a grain of salt when I first said that I was interested in doing this, and now really seeing the success, you know, starting to come a little bit and you know, the results improving. It's been exciting. And, you know, I've had a few comments from people saying, don't you think you really should take up duathlon?
No.
Because I swim so fast.
Duathlon is sort of, you know, there's not much dollars. There's, you know, unless you're doing Olympic or the ITU World Champion. And, it's a different gig. You don't want to. That's like going back to single A. That's going back to single A, right?
I know. And as bad as my swim is, I love triathlon.
Right.
I love the swim bike run, and I wouldn't want to do it any differently. It kind of makes it part of the exciting part of the sport, right?
It's like exactly.
You have great swimmers who maybe aren't great bikers who are great runners, and, you know, there's just such a mix of people. So.
Well, you know, the nice thing is you're probably – would be voted most like least likely to get passed during the race, right? If you compared how many people pass you and how many people you pass, that would be a really cool little study of how many people you pass in a race. Playing your Lady Pac-Man, you know, you're playing Ms. Pac-Man flying through the crowd. What's your goals for this year?
Well, I already said that, you know, on the run, my goal is to consistently be running under under 3 hours, and you know, I think that's something that we feel is really very realistic. We have, you know, some big goals on the bike in terms of trying to establish myself as one of the more dominant cyclists. So, you know, I've got to be able to get stronger, be more strategic, have more efficiency. So there's just a lot of emphasis there. But, you know, I think, you know, my big goal would be a top three finish in Kona. And, you know, the thing about it is and it's something that Matt and I have talked about. Yes, I got seventh place in Kona last year, and I feel so proud of that finish, and I deserve it because I worked really hard. But there are so many incredible women in that race who have the ability to finish in the top three or the top five or the top ten, and you can have the best race of your life and finish 15th there. It's just, it's kind of whatever happens on the day. So, you know, my goal is to go into Kona better prepared and more fit than I was this last year, and be able to execute a performance that tops the one that I did this last year. You know, I just want to continue to improve. So, and, you know, I hope the result speaks for itself.
Well, it's not like you got into the sport when you're, you know, 23, 24 years old. You're coming into the sport at really a peak time. A lot of the top women are between, you know, 33 and 38, right? It's really the type of sport that you can get better as you get a little older.
It's true. It's very true. And yeah, I mean, it's sometimes sad for me in a way, because I'm so passionate about this and I just love it so much. And I, you know, I feel so lucky to be doing this and doing something I love so much. And I do wish that I had kind of discovered it at an earlier age, because, you know, you do only have, unless you're Natasha Bodman, who's like superhuman and was like still killing it at 45, you know, you only have so many years left. But yeah, I mean, I hope that I can, my goal is to be able to keep racing for another 5 or 6 years. I definitely would like to race into my early 40s. And
no reason why not. It's interesting. One time I had Frank Shorter on the show, and we were talking about the peak for an endurance athlete. He says, listen, you get 6 years. You have 6 years to be at the absolute top of your game. And I don't care if you use them when you're in high school, when you use them in college, when you're in your 30s, you're not going to get a lot more than that. If you look at, you know, we just had Ryan Hall on the show, and between 2007 and 2011, the guy had 10 marathons and 9 of them under 212. And he's, you know, he just retired at maybe 33. So, you know, you're starting at the perfect age, right? For you, this is the time. You've got 5 or 6 years to be at the absolute top of your game, because you still, it's not like you're 50, right? You're mid 30s, and you can do some great stuff. I mean, Dave Scott took second in Kona when he was 40. Mab Kofleski just took second at the Olympic trials at 40. You can take a lot of motivation from those folks who are getting better as they age.
For sure. And, you know, actually, one of the things that I loved about Kona this last year is, if you looked at the professional women's field, there are 41 racers, and only 2 of those racers were under the age of 30.
Isn't that amazing?
Eva Woody and Danielle Reif. And everybody else was 30 and over. And I think there were 3 meet racers, maybe 2, that were over 40.
Yep.
So I was really touched by that and inspired by it. Actually, I think it's very cool.
Love it. Love it. Sarah, thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you.
It was really, really a pleasure to get to know you a little bit over the phone. And congrats on an awesome season last year and your big win at Western Australia.
Thanks, Bob. And, you know, thank you so much for having me on. But, you know, it's just such a pleasure to get to talk to you. I genuinely admire everything that you've done for the sport and for, you know, challenge athletes and everything so much. It's like, I think you're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
I really do.
You need to.
Incredible.
Two weeks after Ironman this year, we'll have our event. You need to come down. You'd love it.
I know. Well, I did it actually my first year as a pro. I came down and did it. Yeah, I did the bike portion. I was on a team with Julie Moss.
Yes.
And it was just amazing.
It is amazing.
And I train now with Mo. whom I showed you, Muhammad.
Oh, with Muhammad? Oh, my God.
Yeah, who's totally kicking butt, by the way. And every day that we're in the pool, you know, I'm always laughing because he's, like, out-swimming me. And that's, you know, always saying, you know, some comment to him about, you know, do you want to get the Olympic gold medal? Do you want to get the Olympic gold medal? And he's like this total rock star. He's got a smile on his face. And
I love him. And one of my favorite conversations with him, because you've seen his, obviously, his he's got a deformed leg. And
yes.
When he was a kid, basically what they would do is, because one leg is a lot shorter than the other, and they would just put different pads in on his heels. They would just keep adding. So there's like a little green one and a blue one. And it just got to the point where he's like walking on a foam stilt on one side of his body before they finally goes, okay, this isn't working anymore. We better figure something else out. I love that.
That is so funny. Yeah, he's a great guy. And I don't think he's made the Olympic team yet, is what he told me. I think he still has to go through the qualification process. But I'm just very excited to see how things unfold for him this year. And
he'll kill it.
In Rio. I'm assuming he's going to go because he's
the best.
So.
Yes.
He is, yeah.
So Sarah Piappiano has been our guest. Sarah, thanks again. You are awesome.
Thank you so much, Bob.
We are brought to you by Iron Man U, by EverySite.com, RonCatalina.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, our event is coming up in late October. We've raised over $70 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.